From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Carrie Nolan.
Prosecutors say Army scientist Bruce Ivins was the anthrax killer.
There are 20 pieces of evidence.
The prime suspect committed suicide.
A remarkable news conference this afternoon at the Department of Justice.
The government declares Dr. Bruce Ivins as the only person responsible for those anthrax attacks.
But with the suspect now dead, the government will never have to prove that case in court.
The FBI and Justice Department's evidence against microbiologist and biodefense researcher Bruce Ivins was compelling and convincing. Enough evidence, they said, that they believe they could prove his guilt to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Of course, there will be no jury trial because Ivins committed suicide last week. And while the government's case against him is a strong one, they've been, perhaps, forced to make it in the media. But the media narrative around the anthrax case hasn't always been one of a sociopathic scientist. Salon.com's Glenn Greenwald is a critic of the media coverage over the years and says regardless of Ivan's guilt or innocence, the media have failed in covering this story skeptically going back to 2001.
Much of the discussion in the media early on was very much along the lines of this is the second phase of the attacks by Islamic terrorists on the United States, and early on there emerged the question as to whether or not specifically Iraq was behind the anthrax attack, and that came to dominate how these attacks were discussed early on.
Now, in October of 2001, the ABC News investigative unit did a story about the anthrax letters. They used anonymous sources in that piece, linking the type of anthrax in the letters to Saddam Hussein's regime. In your view, how did the ABC story shape the media narrative about the anthrax letters in those early days?
Beginning on October 26, 2001, ABC touted this claim that tests that were performed at Fort Detrick revealed the presence of what ABC called a chemical additive known as bentonite that ABC claimed was the telltale sign of the Iraqi biological weapons program. And as a result, all sorts of people for years after that went advocating for war in Iraq, cited the ABC story as proof that the anthrax attacks very likely may have come from Saddam Hussein.
We could dedicate our whole interview just to this. ABC's Brian Ross has responded, saying that they reported what their sources believed to be true at the time. But let's move on, and let's talk a little bit about how the coverage has evolved since 2001. I'm thinking specifically about when Stephen Hatfield became a person of interest.
What the government and the media jointly did to Stephen Hatfield is a disgrace. I mean, they literally destroyed his reputation by continuously depicting him as the almost certain murderer who perpetrated the anthrax attacks on the United States. Over and over and over again, the FBI would leak to a whole slew of journalists all sorts of claims that allegedly demonstrated that Hatfield was the only person of interest that the FBI was even looking at. They did things like alert ABC News ahead of time when they searched his apartment wearing bioweapon suits to create these pictures around Stephen Hatfield's residence of the government going in with these, you know, very dramatic outfits. All along, there was zero evidence linking Stephen Hatfield to the anthrax attacks. It was a lynch mob that was achieved through anonymous leaks, which journalists then uncritically reported until the country was convinced that he was the killer.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit from that to Bruce Ivins.
From the very first moment that the Los Angeles Times broke the story that Bruce Ivins had committed suicide, apparently, and was the latest lead suspect in the FBI's investigation, there has been a concerted effort on the part of the FBI to depict him as this very unattractive personality so that any accusations thereafter will find a receptive public. And what the media has done, by and large, with some important exceptions, has been to just regurgitate what the government has been leaking. For example, in the Washington Post, there was an article that rather vocally touted what they depicted as this almost smoking gun type of evidence, which was that Bruce Ivins in 2001 had obtained what the Washington Post described as a sophisticated piece of machinery called a lyophilizer which, according to the Post, enables somebody to take wet samples of anthrax and convert them into the type of dry spores that was sent to Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy. And according to the Post, this was a device that Bruce Ivins had no reason in the course of his work to use. Now, in fact, I interviewed several different experts who essentially said that for a researcher like Ivins researching anthrax vaccines, a lyophilizer is essentially the equivalent of an accountant using a pencil.
Is it possible that media coverage in this 24-hour culture can be measured and subtle?
You know, I think the problem is that what we see now is there's this premium on being fast and first, and what that means is simply running with whatever government sources say and then not stopping along the way to investigate or get any countervailing perspective.
Glenn Greenwald, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional lawyer, now a columnist for Salon.com. As I mentioned, ABC's Brian Ross did address the controversy over his 2001 story linking the anthrax attacks to Iraq in an interview with the website TV Newser this week. Ross says ABC News was not lied to by their sources and that ABC reported what their sources, who were, quote, current and former government scientists, thought to be true at the time. We'll link to that interview on our site.
Painstaking investigation led us to the conclusion that Dr. Bruce E. Ivins was responsible for the death, sickness, and fear brought to our country by the 2001 anthrax mailing, and that it appears, based on the evidence, that he was acting alone.
The FBI's Joseph Persicini Wednesday laying out the anthrax case for a room full of reporters and cameras. Sure enough, the evidence against the late Dr. Ivins was impressive. He was one of a small number of Fort Detrick scientists with access to the killer spores. He had a long history of mental instability. He had allegedly provided a false sample of anthrax in the early stages of the probe to throw investigators off the scent. He had a history of sending anonymous letters. And in an email to a colleague days before the first anthrax deaths, he used phrasing that resembled the threats in the anthrax mail. Circumstantial as it is, a pretty strong case. But the government thought it had a strong case against Stephen Hatfield, too, and against the late Richard Jewell, once sweated as the lone suspect in the Atlanta Olympic bombing, and against Wen-Ho Lee, the nuclear scientist portrayed in the New York Times as a Chinese spy. Law enforcement leaks to eager reporters had tarred them. All of which made the week's stunning anthrax revelations and the press conference confusing to process. Was this finally the real deal and Ivins' suicide an admission of guilt? Or perhaps was Ivins another hapless victim of FBI persecution? The recent history of government bungling hung over the coverage like a pall, resulting in the odd spectacle of news organizations pressuring the Justice Department for every last detail, while simultaneously searching for evidence that the evidence was flawed. The irony was not lost on John Miller, a former ABC News reporter, now Assistant Director for Public Affairs at the FBI.
I find, having been on both sides of this fence, that there is no shared sense of responsibility here. There is intensive criticism, ironically, by the media for so-called government leaks by anonymous sources, especially in cases where individuals later turn out to be perhaps not the right subject of the investigation. Yet it is the same media that put pressure on people, try to pull information out of them, then publish it, and then seem to be shocked and turn to blame the government. I find the lack of shared responsibility kind of compelling.
One of the reasons for Wednesday's press conference was to reassure the country that the case was actually solved. It seemed to me that there was another reason as well, and that was to address the tremendous amount of skepticism from Ivan's colleagues and even some of his victims that this guy could possibly have been the killer. To me, anyway, it looked like the government was saying, no, really, wolf, wolf. And a lot of the villagers were tired of running up the hill.
I would disagree with all of that. The reason for the press conference is we had an obligation to disclose to the victims and to their families the information we had. To do so, though, we had to make certain documents public. Once that happened, there's also a larger public that still suffers from anxiety, and they needed to be reassured. And thirdly, Congress was actually a target of the attacks and has always had a strong interest in where the case was. And we've had prohibitions from being able to brief them in detail because of some of those legal rules. So we had three core audiences, and we had to tell them what we had. It wasn't that we wanted to convince skeptics.
But hold on, John. In each of those core audiences, there were skeptics going quite public with their skepticism about the case that the FBI was going to present.
We have nothing to sell here. This isn't a marketing effort. We have an obligation in terms of disclosure. We were trying to meet that obligation. And what I've seen over the last couple of days, which is predictable, and you've made this point pretty well, is, you know, people say, well, questions linger. It's not an airtight case. You know, the only airtight cases happen on TV at night on CSI. In every case that ever mattered, questions, there were lingering questions. That is the nature of the beast. In fact, that's why in our legal system, we are expected to take things to court and prove them beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond the shadow of a doubt. And that is where this case is.
Do you disagree that the FBI and the Justice Department were at pains considering the recent history of these high-profile investigations into the wrong guy to give more disclosure than it's typically comfortable with? I mean, I just can't believe that what happened in that history didn't inform how you handled this.
It certainly informed how we handled this to the extent that there was great pain over issues involving Richard Jewell. There was obviously a lot of discussion and lessons learned from issues involving Wenho Lee and disclosures in those cases. And when we got into the issue of Dr. Ivins, I think you can see that that investigation carried on for a period of years without his name leaking out. And that because there was a very concentrated effort to contain that information by very responsible people who worked very hard to maintain the security around that information. I think that because there wasn't any leak of that, it certainly shows that worked.
John, thank you very much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Bob. Always good to be here.
John Miller is Assistant Director for Public Affairs at the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
A year and a half ago, Jody Rosen, music critic for Slate.com, wrote a profile of Jimmy Buffett. It was a mildly snarky look at everyone's favorite songwriter of alcohol-themed beach sing-alongs, and the piece was posted to Slate's website. And that was that. Until a few weeks ago, when Rosen received an email.
The email said, "I thought you should know that your piece on Jimmy Buffett was published again under someone else's byline, virtually word for word." The reader sent along a link to the website of a newspaper called The Bulletin, which is an alternative weekly published in Montgomery County, Texas, in the suburbs north of Houston. And so I clicked on the link, and basically my entire piece was repurposed there. It was very slightly changed. The grammar was tweaked a bit under the byline Mark Williams.
So what happens then? You click through, you see that your article has been co-opted.
I suppose I should say that I was indignant about this, but I was more bewildered and kind of amused just because of the audacity of it. You know, I thought about it for a second. I said, this guy's clearly some rogue writer. You know, the collegial thing to do is to inform his editor. So I tracked down the name of the publisher, who I later found out was the publisher and editor, a guy named Mike Ladyman. And I called Mike Ladyman and said, hey, you know, I think you should know that this writer of yours has been plagiarizing. And he said, wow, thanks for telling me. I'll look into that. And that was that.
Now, you eventually realized that you weren't the only writer being co-opted by this Mark Williams.
That's right. After I got off the phone with Ladyman for the first time, I felt like, you know, that was sort of a strange conversation. So I started clicking around the website. This alternative weekly sort of has two types of content. It's generally pop music, reviews, criticism, profiles, what have you, and left-leaning political punditry. I looked at this profile of Willie Nelson, and it seemed suspiciously well-written to me. And I Googled a couple phrases, and sure enough, right away, I came up with a hit. And in fact, much of the piece had been taken from an article in The Guardian, the London-based newspaper. At which point, I was off to the races. I just started doing it on every article I turned up.
So what did you find?
I discovered that Mark Williams, who incidentally was the only writer for the last several years in the Bulletin who actually is bylined in the paper, all of his music pieces for the last several years, since at least 2005, were plagiarized in some fashion. Many of them were cobbled together from multiple sources. Articles that were taken from USA Today and the Boston Globe and the Dallas Observer, which is an alt-weekly out of Dallas. There was another piece of mine that was lifted. And then I found that the political op-eds, which are unbylined, for a period of years were mostly taken from the website Salon.com, and a disproportionate number of them were the work of Joe Connison, the left-leaning pundit.
Obviously, this Montgomery County Bulletin is a small paper, and this is not going to make huge waves across the journalistic community. But do you think this means that if a paper is small enough and nobody is really paying that much attention to it, that it can get away with virtually anything?
Virtually anything, I don't know, but I think it can get away with a lot. I don't think this is practiced all that often. My feeling is that most journalists have integrity about these issues. I think this is a, you know, kind of a rogue newspaper. But that said, I have gotten a number of emails from journalists who said, oh, yeah, this happened to me. This happens a lot more often than you think. And, you know, interestingly, in the case of the Bulletin, it is, as I say, a free alternative weekly whose revenues come from paid advertising in the print edition. So it didn't really need to have a website. And unfortunately for them, that's what wound up kind of biting them in the tail, because they might have gotten away with this very easily had the newspaper not opened itself up to Google searches.
Well, in your piece describing this whole episode, you wonder whether the Bulletin is just the natural extension of the age of news aggregation, those are websites that don't create any original content and instead just link stories from major news outlets. And they also generate huge traffic. They become big names. But still, those sites don't replace bylines. And they always send the reader to the original source with a link. Isn't this something completely different?
I know it is. And I was being a little cheeky when I said that. And it's funny, I've gotten a lot of angry emails. I wasn't trying to liken the plagiarism of the Montgomery County Bulletin to the legitimate linking practices of news aggregators like the Drudge Report and the Huffington Post and Real Clear Politics. What I was saying, though, is that in its way, the Montgomery County Bulletin is an aggregator. Its aggregation practices are highly unethical and wrong. However, what it is doing is gathering journalism from a variety of sources. The Bulletin is just about the most endangered journalistic species, right? It's a tiny regional alternative weekly. It certainly is not long for this world, and I think many papers that fit that description aren't in the age of 21st century internet news. But what struck me is that it was kind of applying 21st century guerrilla style aggregation to this endangered 20th century medium. I don't think they succeeded.
Jody Rosen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Jody Rosen is the music critic for Slate.
We spoke with Mike Ladyman, publisher of the paper, who didn't deny the charges that Mark Williams plagiarized. He did send us some articles by Williams that do check out, as far as we can tell. Williams also spoke with us and read a statement that attempted to explain it all as an isolated error. An open letter to Jody Rosen, it never acknowledged the charges of systematic plagiarism, but instead lashed out at the accuser.
It's easy to make fun of our little rag, Mr. Rosen, to call attention to the gaffes and human foibles of a couple of faceless rubes a half a nation away. But despite your grievances with our publication, I feel that we have done some good in our corner of the world. Through our output of articles through the years, we kept a hateful rogue element of the local Republican Party from taking control of our county library system and ripping the Constitution to shreds. We have reported unblinkingly on the troubled plight of illegal aliens living in our area. In short, we have called attention to a number of injustices in our crappy little town, both great and small. So there it is, Mr. Rosen. Congratulations on breaking an already fragile soul. Best regards to Jimmy Buffett, Mark Williams, The Bulletin, Conroe, Texas.
Mark Williams resigned from the Montgomery County Bulletin this week. And now for a few of your letters. Many of you weighed in on our segment about the comments readers leave on websites, comments we said were, quote, sometimes frustrating, maddening, and extremely discouraging. Ethan Stanislavski of New York City registered frustration of his own with, naturally a comment on our website. He wrote, quote, "The internet has not dumbed down human rhetoric. Newspapers always got angry, hateful letters. The internet has just made it easier to send that kind of message for people who wouldn't go the extra mile and pay postage. That's why if newspapers are to have comments, they need to regulate them to the same extent they regulate letters to the editor." Mike from Phoenix, Arizona, took it a step further. Quote, "You should make people sign up for a username and password and log internet protocol addresses for all who post. That way you can IP ban the worst offenders. Failing that, just disable the thing. There's no reason all media need be interactive." Well, Mike, disabling the thing is exactly what our friends at This American Life did when their discussion forum devolved into a series of ad hominems directed at their guests. Host Ira Glass talked about the decision to do away with comments on our show a couple of weeks ago, but not everyone saw it his way. Catherine D. wrote, "Wow, I just kept waiting for both of you to say, 'You kids get off of my digital lawn!' Pathetic." And finally, Jules from Chicago wrote, "If we allow pornography to be in plain sight on newsstands, what's wrong with stating one's opinion of someone else's politics or beliefs or opinions in an insulting way? As we've heard so many times before, our freedoms come at a high price. Like it or not, it's an all-or-nothing package." Whether we like them or not, we hope you keep your comments coming. Send them to our inbox at onthemedia@wnyc.org or post them publicly on our website at onthemedia.org.
For New York Times reporter David Carr, it was the story of a lifetime. A hard-charging reporter who built a career chasing complicated stories, working his way up to a position at the New York Times, all while doing a tremendous number of drugs and living the kind of reprehensible lifestyle that would make for a lurid, depressing series on utter self-destruction. The story, of course, is Carr's own, and a few years ago he set out to tell it himself. Knowing full well that he was his most unreliable witness, he brought the rigor of journalism to his own memoir, and the result is The Night of the Gun. David, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Carrie.
Now, you concede in the book that the rules that you set out for yourself were kind of a conceit. So can you explain what those rules were?
When an event was described, I tried to go out and triangulate, find other people that saw it, participated in it. I tried to find underlying documents. I tried to correlate photos to different times. There are things I didn't find that I wanted, but I hired two private investigators. They didn't work out very well. And then I hired a separate reporter who I respected and admired a lot, Don Jacobson, a reporter in Minneapolis. And Don found some things that I couldn't find, and the things that he could not find, I was able to write more confidently that they could not be found because it wasn't just me. All those things sort of came together with the need to come up with some kind of concept that would make what is an almost sort of generic story of abasement followed by redemption interesting to the reader. So it was sort of need, skill set, plus gimmick meeting the moment.
Were you also just a little bit aware of the James Frey memoir, A Million Little Pieces?
I was more than aware of it. I had done a story about when he went on Oprah and Oprah tore off his arms and legs in front of millions. And I'd say that made a little bit of an impression on me.
I'm sure. So given all of that, why write the book?
I thought I could write a really excellent book. 20 years ago, I was fresh off a 10-year addiction to cocaine. I was on welfare. I had just gotten custody of my twin baby girls. And I thought to myself, look what happened to me. I was supposedly a hopeless case. People would ask me, how did that happen? How did that guy become this guy? And I thought it would be better to sort of investigate as opposed to just pontificate.
So as a storyteller, apart from the journalistic rigor, did you find that you were kind of forcing yourself to reveal the most lurid details? Was that serving your story?
I came across things, moments in interviews and episodes that I really didn't even want to share with my wife, to be honest. And when it came time to write the book, I ended up looking at that stuff and I thought, you know, if I shave a single corner so it feels better to me, then the whole thing will sort of fall apart. And so I just said, I am writing this book about another person, and I want it to be fair, and I want everything to be in context, but I don't want to bathe it in pathos. I don't want to explain or excuse. I want to relate what happened as straightforwardly as I can. So that's one thing, to write that.
Okay.
But then you put it out there, and you turn into that guy. And that's where I am right now. My story changed when I reported it, but it also changed when I wrote it.
Let's talk a little bit about when you were using and you were working. And, you know, you say how in Minnesota you tried to keep your arrests and crime reporting separate.
Usually a good policy, I would say.
Was there any upside to skating in those two parallel worlds at the same time?
Well, it certainly wasn't worth what it cost me in terms of human dignity and violence against others. But in terms of what I learned from those days, I'm not really afraid of that much. And that means if I have to go on a media interview and talk about my book, I'm not going to be that worried about that. And the other thing is, there are gangsters in all walks of life, and some of them wear pinstripes, and some of them wish to intimidate and lay you low. And I feel I can do a real, actual threat assessment when I'm with someone and suss out whether they can really do me harm. And that's, I guess, one of the few gifts of, you know, a really wayward history.
When an excerpt from your book appeared in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago, a lot of people wondered in the online comments why they should ever trust you again, that addicts are inherently liars, and hopefully journalists aren't. So having laid it all out in book form for us, why should we trust you?
You show me where one of my stories ever came up bad, and I don't care when it was from in my career, what it was about, who I was doing. This is not a story about journalistic pathology, nothing of the kind. I work at the New York Times. I'm proud of the principles we have in common. I've displayed none of the pathology that has occasionally infected journalism, and the proof is in the pudding week after week after week. The matter of trustworthiness, if you go within the four corners of the book, I don't really ask the reader to trust me. All the documentation is baked in. The witness of others is there. Just in case that doesn't do it for you, there's a website where much of my reporting is up there for inspection. There's a transparency that should give it some sense of verisimilitude. Doesn't mean every word is true. Does not. Like all human endeavors, it's subject to shortages of either attention or effort. It just means that it was as true as I can make it. And if I thought I was going to be imperiling my reputation as a journalist, I probably wouldn't have done the book.
You've been writing about media and celebrities for a while now. How cynical are you about the role that these redemption narratives play in our culture?
Not one little bit. When I did that magazine article, I got 1,200 emails. At least half of them were from people either seeking or seeking on behalf of others some route out of the prison that addiction 20, 30, 40 million Americans live in. Now, I'm not saying I have any expertise in that regard. I obviously have had my own struggles. I have some cynicism, I guess, about the commercial aspects of it. I think that there was probably some cynicism in the conception of the book in terms of if I took this and this and put it together, maybe there'd be a market for that. But I don't think in the main that it was a cynical endeavor. If it was, it would have been a very different book.
Is it cynical to think that the presumed success of this book is going to change your process of getting stories, of getting people to open up to you?
Really worried about that. You know, I got to the New York Times, and I had never worked at a daily, so I was really determined to fit in. And I did a really good job 4 or 5 years of fitting in, and now I'm in the business of sticking out. And there's a real standard at the place. So many people do magnificent things, and you would never know their name. And I'm no longer one of those people. I don't just get in the boat and row. I'm always going to be that guy. So the elevator ride at the place is going to be different. And now I opened up, you know, my browser on Monday, and I was just terrified I was going to see my mug one more time. You know, that guy, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm totally sick of seeing, you know, see the man who stuck things up his nose. And I opened up, and of course, there I was, but it was for a column I wrote about the New Jersey Star-Ledger. And I tell you, my heart just burst because I don't plan on writing about myself the rest of my life. I plan on doing what most journalists do, which is finding people more interesting than me, putting a microphone to them, finding out their stories and telling them. And if I've dinged that, if I've damaged that, and I think that there's a chance of that, that'll be really sad for me.
David Carr, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
David Carr is a media columnist for the New York Times and author of Night of the Gun.
Coming up, 3D movies will be coming at you from every direction.
If only someone would build the theaters.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Carrie Nolan.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When you look at the raw numbers, the film industry seems to be doing pretty well, especially when compared to the music and television industries. Box office revenue for 2007 was $9.6 billion, up 5% from the previous year. But that increase almost entirely reflects a boost in ticket prices. As the population has grown, the number of tickets sold has remained flat. And with advances in the picture and sound quality of home theaters, the ubiquity of DVDs, and increasingly cinematic video games, the film industry is looking to restore the Cineplex as an indispensable entertainment destination. But how? Some of their hopes lie in utilizing new digital 3D technology. The next Pixar film will be in 3D, as will re-releases of the first two Toy Story movies. James Cameron, Peter Jackson, and Robert Zemeckis all have 3D movies in production, and DreamWorks' Jeffrey Katzenberg has announced that all of its future animated films will boldly go into the third dimension. Kevin Maney, a writer for Portfolio magazine, thinks there are still some serious hurdles the industry must overcome for 3B to be the cure for all of the industry's woes. But Maney also says the technology is a far cry from the cardboard glasses and blurry images from the previous generation of 3D films.
The difference is huge. The new technology is so much better. So in the old days, you had two images that a projectionist had to overlap in a certain way and put together. And as the film played, sometimes it moved a little bit, or, you know, this is the second reel went in, it wasn't quite lined up where the first reel was. So the people watching it would get headaches and nausea. So, you know, I mean, that wasn't quite a great way to sell a movie.
Or popcorn.
Boy, I know. Yeah, really, exactly. And these days, it's all digital, so there's no moving parts, and it's rock solid. So that gets away from all of the headache, nausea problems. The glasses are not two different colors. They're actually polarized lenses that make one eye see one image, one eye see the other, which actually combined makes the 3D image in your brain. So it's really, it's much more of an effective kind of solution.
Not long ago, I experienced some of the modern 3D technology. It was in a short film at the museum, and it truly was stunning. But so stunning, actually, that I don't even remember what the film was about. I mean, it's kind of antithetical to storytelling. And if storytelling is the heart of movie making, is there no risk that the technology will just overwhelm what Hollywood has always done best, and that's spin a narrative?
That's something that hopefully will get taken care of when you get some really A-list directors, folks like James Cameron, trying to do 3D movies and using the 3D technology as a part of the storytelling, as a way to enhance the story and not play tricks. Journey to the Center of the Earth, which is the first big live-action 3D movie, it's, you know, out this summer, is an example of there's a lot of just playing with the technology, doing gratuitous things like having birds fly out at you or an antenna poked right towards you. It's not serving the story. That will change as the technology matures and as directors who are really more interested in telling a story get a hold of it.
One answer might be that eventually people will be so accustomed to it, like they are accustomed to color and sound, that they won't be comfortable unless they're watching a film in 3D. But I gather that nobody really thinks that anyone's going to re-release the works of Ingmar Bergman, you know, in three dimensions.
No, I don't think so. I think the small films, the things that are about two people, you know, talking, there's no real reason to have those be in 3D. Maybe way down the line somewhere, but probably in the short term, no. The way that people in Hollywood have explained it to me is that they think that there will be a time in the nearer future when everybody expects the big blockbuster movie, something like a Titanic or Indiana Jones, you know, 27, something that you'd expect it to be in 3D.
You talk about a chicken and egg proposition in your piece, the idea that theaters have to spend like $100,000 per screen to equip theaters with 3D, and they don't want to do that unless there's a marketplace, but the marketplace depends on the ability to project 3D films. How is that going to play out?
Well, one of the things that Hollywood's trying to do is actually the studios are trying to combine together and put together a big financing package to actually help pay for the 3D systems to go into theaters. Jeffrey Katzenberg at DreamWorks has been pushing this hard for past 6 months or a year and has really not had much success in striking a deal that really works. But Hollywood definitely knows that this isn't going to work unless they can convince the movie theaters to put in this expensive equipment. Journey to the Center of the Earth, when it came out in July, Walden Media, which financed it, originally expected there would be 1,700 theaters that would be fully equipped with 3D to do this. It turned out there were maybe 1,000 or 1,100. So that really squashed some of its plans for the big 3D rollout. Katzenberg is hoping there's going to be 5,000 theaters that are 3D ready by like next year, and it's not even going to come close.
There's another problem. If the movie industry is indeed threatened by home video and by video games and experiences that you can have, you know, without having to schlep to the multiplex, TV is going to be 3D ready pretty soon. Is it possible that this technology will essentially skip the theatrical exhibition industry altogether and take root in our own family rooms?
Actually, since the piece came out, there was an interesting development, which was that the MPAA, the Hollywood representative, started talking about trying to create a standard for 3D for home television, which would seem to undermine this idea of putting 3D into movie theaters as a way to get people out of their homes and into movie theaters. I talked with an interesting sort of human economist named Tyler Cowen. And he made the point that people don't go to the movie theater necessarily to see a movie. They go because it's a destination. It's sort of a predefined kind of situation and amount of time. And there's some entertainment that's involved too and gives you something to talk about afterwards. If that's true, then trying to increase the fidelity of that experience, it's not a way to really change the way people think about going out to the movies. So what is that way? The industry is experimenting a lot right now, trying to make theaters more of a social place, more of like a lounge or a club with couches and waitress service and things like that, and actually maybe encouraging people to talk instead of saying, sit there and shut up, you know, because everybody's watching the movie. So it's a little bit more of a social thing, and maybe that will add enough to the experience to make people want to come out.
Kevin Maney writes for Portfolio Magazine. His latest piece is titled The 3D Dilemma. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
3D images aren't new to 2008, and they weren't new to the 1950s either. In fact, it was in the 1830s that British scientist Sir Charles Wheatstone invented the stereoscope, a device that created the illusion of depth in two-dimensional images. Nearly a century later, a couple of enterprising Americans figured out a way to adapt that technology to moving pictures, and so they did. Frederick Ives and Jacob Leventhal directed a series of silent films, Ouch, Lunacy, Zowie, and A Runaway Taxi, in 3D. They weren't exactly the runaway blockbusters of the Roaring Twenties, but they did give moviegoers a hint of what was possible. Ray Zone is the author of 3D Filmmakers, Conversations with Creators of Stereoscopic Motion Pictures. He says that 1939, the year of Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, was also a landmark year in 3D. At the New York World's Fair, the Chrysler Pavilion featured a film later retitled Motor Rhythm, billed as, quote, a miracle of music and animation. Zone says that millions got to see that 3D movie, a stop-motion short of a Chrysler, assembling itself.
Motor Rhythm marked the beginning of the classical twin-strip 3D movie process. That is, two cameras shoot the movie and two projectors project it onto a silver screen through polarizing filters, which are the same filters that the audience uses to view the film in 3D.
Now, in the 50s, the 1950s, when television had found its way into almost every American living room, Hollywood was undergoing a slump much like the slump it's undergoing today, and the studios were desperate to get people back into the movie houses. And along comes a film titled Buona Devil.
Buona Devil was an African adventure originally titled The Lions of Gulu. It was based on a true historic occurrence in the 1890s in Africa, where lions persisted in consuming workers who were on site to build a railroad. Bob Stack played the lead, and the romantic female counterpart was Barbara Britton. They shot Buona Devil with the Natural Vision twin camera system in the Malibu Hills, which stood in for Africa. It actually did that very well. Nigel Bruce, famous for his work in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, also had a part in the film.
So Robert Stack, Elliot Ness, and Nigel Bruce, who was Dr. Watson.
That's correct.
These were the stars of Buona Devil. Now, these guys are not, in current parlance, known for being able to open a movie. They weren't big superstars. And yet Buona Devil was a phenomenal success.
Life magazine actually characterized the film as cheap and preposterous, but the 3D effects just knocked people out. There were lines around the block. And 2 days after Buona Devil opened at the Paramount Theaters, Jack Warner of Warner Brothers licensed the Natural Vision process so that he could go into immediate production with the first Warner Brothers 3D release, House of Wax. House of Wax tells the story of a frustrated artist, Vincent Price, who creates wax figures of scenes from history and famous characters.
This is where I recreated my Joan of Arc. It's an interesting process. If you have patience with me, my dear, I'll show you how it's done.
When they are destroyed in a fire and Price himself horribly disfigured, he decides to capitalize on the public's appetite for thrills and creates a chamber of horrors featuring famous murderers from history.
I'm rebuilding my exhibition from the ground up. I'm going to give the people what they want. Sensation, horror, shock. Send them out in the streets to tell their friends how wonderful it is to be scared to death.
Still a gold standard for 3D movie making. Ironically, it was directed by André de Toth, who only had one eye. That's correct. He had monocular vision.
I was so not expecting you to say that.
Well, he just simply had a great understanding of how depth is depicted, both in 2D and 3D. So some of the scenes in House of Wax make a great use of the effect to have objects emerge from the audience and walk into the screen.
Now, as much as a phenomenon as 3D films were in the 50s and early 60s, they kind of came and went and were scarcely heard from for decades, except for one brief interlude in 1969 with a movie called The Stewardesses, which was a softcore porn 3D movie.
The Stewardesses marked the beginnings of single-strip 3D movie technology, both for the camera and projection in the theater, where the left and right eye views were either stacked on top of each other or squeezed and put side by side on a single 35mm frame. And it came out at a time when there were no 3D films in the feature film marketplace. So it did very well. It opened in 1969 in two theaters, one in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco. And then in subsequently different versions, had an increasingly wide release. It has grossed in today's dollars over $100 million.
Well, grossed would seem to be the key word. It's hard for me to imagine, and I'm not sure I even want to know the answer, but in exactly what part of the porn storytelling was the 3D invoked?
In the stewardesses, there is surprisingly little aviation. Shots of aviation, airplanes taking off and so forth, are expensive to shoot.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just completed the overwater portion of our flight and are now entering the traffic pattern of Los Angeles International Airport. Please fasten your seatbelts and raise the seats to the full upright positions.
Most of the stewardesses takes place on the ground and depicts the dalliances of the title characters. One strong section in the film has a amusement park where they visit some of the traditional attractions, like ride in a fun house. It's thin on story, but its strength was there were no other 3D movies out there.
Another fallow period into the 80s, and then Friday the 13th Part 3. Was that different technologically than previous attempts at 3D?
It was also single strip 3D, but Friday the 13th,
what's going on?
Part 3 in 3D marked a landmark date in the history of 3D movies in that it was the first day and date release.
Oh my God!
August 12, 1982, it opened 1,200 theaters in North America. For that release, the theaters had to install silver screens, and Paramount built projection lenses in serially numbered cases with instructions for the projectionist and a test loop as to how to mount the lens on the projector and project it properly in 3D.
Now, one thing that struck me when I saw a 3D short film, the effect in modern days is just truly stunning. I mean, it is really remarkable how the images on the screen just jump out at you. But they're so stunning, so arresting, that it's almost impossible to follow the story because every 3 seconds you're being wowed practically out of your seat.
Absolutely. It's one of the artistic problems of the 3D movie, and that is using the 3D for storytelling and not in a way that it calls attention to itself and destroys the suspension of disbelief. In fact, when André de Toth directed House of Wax, the producer compelled him to put the famous paddle ball sequence in there, which is irrelevant to the story.
Hold steady now, don't move your head, or you'll lose the powder off your nose.
There's a guy who's basically a pitchman, a barker, out in front of the museum. He's shilling to the crowd to have them come in and see the new Chamber of Horrors, and he's got a paddle ball.
See the lovely sinners of ancient times, ladies and gentlemen, beauties who died in torture and on the block. Visit our Chamber of Horrors.
And then he makes it go right out at the camera, so it's out in the audience. It is so prominent and so gratuitous, and that's a historic problem. That is still a problem for 3D movies to become a mature storytelling art where the 3D is used in a narrative way. It needs to be done.
Ray, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for visiting with me.
Ray Zone is the author of Stereoscopic Cinema and the Origins of 3D Film, 1838 to 1952.
Who are you?
His website is ray3dzone.com.
Hey, now cut that out right now. That's not funny.
Last week, we launched Project OTM T-shirt, in which we give you the information and you design an on-the-media T-shirt. This week, in order to demonstrate my personal commitment and enthusiasm for Project OTM T-shirt, I'm announcing that I will be doing this show topless from now until August 25th, when we select the winning design. So go to onthemedia.org, where you can find all the rules and regs for submitting your original on-the-media T-shirt design. And thanks for all the fabulous submissions we've received so far. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Folo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by all of the above. We had help from Michael Bernstein, technical direction from Jennifer Munson, and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke will be back next week. I'm Carrie Nolan.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.